This is starting a couple of minutes late, about 4 minutes late. So in Imperial China, they had a system of laws which pretty clearly was intended to be a complete system for describing the penalty for any offense. A very detailed legal system. They had printing, after all, early on. And you have the legal code, the commentaries in another color, I think a second commentary in another color, a very elaborate system. This is roughly 18th, 19th century China. And then it always turned out that there were cases that didn't fit any of the categories that this elaborate system covered. And then they had a couple of rules for how you dealt with those. One of them was argument by analogy. You say, well, this action is sort of like this action, but not quite as bad, so it's the same penalty down one step. And then finally, there was a blanket category, doing what ought not to be done. In fact, there were two of them. The other, I think, was disobeying an imperial command, which did not actually require that the command had been made. It could just be a command the emperor would have made if he'd known about it. So those were used as sort of covering, disturbing the peace might be an equivalent in a modern legal system that's not very well defined, and it's what they charge you with if you're doing something they disapprove of and they aren't exactly sure what. So it just seemed to me it was intriguing looking at these different legal systems and trying to make sense of their different approaches to solving problems, most of which, maybe all of which, exist in our legal system as well. It's also useful in a number of other ways. One of them is in terms of an economist trying to apply economic analysis of law. If economic analysis of law is any good, it shouldn't be limited to modern American law. And so it's nice to see whether to some degree you can make sense of, if not what the rules were, at least how they worked out, what happened in different legal systems within the economic model of behavior. Furthermore, I think it's a useful way of getting ideas, that various of the ideas that show up in my book actually originated with my looking at mostly Saga period Iceland, to some extent 18th century England, and trying to understand how those systems worked. And sometimes it turns out that people in the past were cleverer than we are, or at least had in one way or another ideas we might imitate. So that, going back to the Greeks for a moment, something I learned much later, the Greeks had huge juries, like 400 people or so. And I think the jury system was partly a welfare system, that the jurors were paid and the payment was such that poor people who had nothing better to do could sort of make a minimal kind of survival on that. In the Greek system, I should say a lot of systems don't have our crime-tort division in our form. There are quite a lot of systems where most of the criminal enforcement is really decentralized the way our tort system is, rather than centralized in the state. And as I'll be discussing later, that's true of something as close to ours as 18th century England. That in 18th century England, criminal law was in fact enforced by the victim, mostly the victim's agents, not by the state police, although of course you've got a state authority in some sense to hang the guy when the process is over and to conduct the trials. And in the Athenian system, there was the equivalent of criminal tort distinction was between those offenses which could only be prosecuted by the victim, our torts, and those which could be prosecuted by essentially anybody who wanted to do it, and those are the equivalent of our criminal. And typically, the punishment for an offense was a fine, sometimes a very large fine, and typically the prosecutor got a sizable chunk of that fine. So that raises an obvious problem of abusive litigation. And one of their solutions to that was if the prosecutor failed to get, I think it was 30% of the votes of the jury, the prosecutor got fined. And I don't know if it would work in our system, but it's sort of an interesting thought to imagine. What if you had some sanction in tort law, maybe even in criminal law, which basically said if 2/3 of the juries think this guy's innocent, you shouldn't have charged him, and therefore you owe him compensation, or you shouldn't have sued him, and therefore you ought to have to pay his legal expenses. There are different ways you could do it, but it just struck me as sort of a neat and interesting idea from sort of the feeling I get about ancient Athens is a whole bunch of very bright, somewhat impractical people making up legal rules, if that makes sense. And so I'm not sure all of them worked, but they were clever and interesting, some of them. Anyway, And finally, in addition to getting ideas of things you might do, you can also learn a little bit about what happens when you do them. You can say, all right, here is a legal system which did X. What problems arose? How did they deal with it? Things of that sort. And I think there are some real examples. And the book discusses three examples of this. The first is the one that I originally started with, as I think I mentioned last time, the one that really got me into doing law instead of other applications of economics, and that was Saga Period Iceland. And that was what I like to think of as a pure tort system, in that what we think of as criminal offenses were prosecuted the way we would prosecute a tort offense, by the victim, or if the victim was dead, the victim's heirs, in effect, his kinsmen, suing the offender and getting a money damage payment as a result. But it was a much purer tort system than ours, because not only did the state not catch the criminals, it didn't enforce the judgments either. So that there was, this was a society which had no executive arm of government, as we'll see in a little, and in which the punishing of somebody who failed to pay the fine was up to the plaintiff, essentially, and his friends. Second one is 18th century England, which I got onto much later, and which was a system which on paper looks more or less like ours. It's what ours came out of, after all. The only thing is there were no police or public prosecutors. That's a slight exaggeration. If you actually committed a crime against the crown, if you robbed the mails or something, then there were people who were hired by the crown to prosecute you. But if all you did was to kill somebody or steal from somebody, then figuring out who did it was up to private parties. And then the final one is Shasta County, a couple of hours from here, which Bob Ellickson did a very good book on, which, you know, you may have read my summary in the chapter, and I'll be discussing it here, just analyzing their system of private norms. It was basically private norms of neighborly behavior in a reasonably stable society where people are neighbors for a long time. And it turned out that for certain sorts of issues, the private norms of neighborly behavior de facto trumped the laws of the state of California, because there were a couple of issues where California law explicitly said, this is what happens, and it wasn't what happened. In my seminar, which those of you who are second-year students have the option of taking next year, next spring, if you feel like it, we cover a whole bunch more. I think we've got about 10 societies in that one. I think I may add ancient Jewish law to that one, because I was just coming across a reference somewhere which may be a pointer to where I would find a good primary source on what that was like. But in any case, we start with gypsies, modern gypsies, Imperial China, Saga Period Iceland, which you now know a little bit about, Cheyenne Indians. One of my students did a very good paper on the Amish, and we discussed that one. Several of my students have done papers on pirates, and they discuss that a little bit, the internal rules by which pirates ran their ships mostly, a bunch of other stuff of that sort. So it's fun, and I really created it because I'd gotten lazy. I realized that I'd gotten a lot of sort of intellectual stimulation out of these two papers, one on Iceland and one on England. Shasta County, all I did was a book review of Ellickson's book, which is what I got into that. I hadn't done anything like that for a decade or more, I think, or something like that, and I figured I ought to find some way of sticking a pin in myself to make myself learn something new, and so I created the seminar. And I've been happy with it. So someday it'll be a book, but that requires that I have more unifying ideas than I yet have. You need more than just data for a book. Any questions before we start actually going into the substance of these societies? So, very brief summary of Icelandic history. Harald Haarfagr was king of one of the small kingdoms that made up Norway back in the 9th century. The traditional story, I have no idea if it's true, is that he courted a princess of some other kingdom and she said, Harald is too small a king for me. And that Harald swore he would neither wash nor comb his hair until he had made himself king of all Norway. And he set out to do so. For a while they called him Shaggy Harald, and he succeeded in creating what we now call Norway, at which point he washed his hair and probably had a haircut or something, and then they called him Harald Haarfagr, Harald Fairhair. And what he did was not just to unify Norway, but to create a stronger royal authority than previously existed. That essentially he shifted it to something like what we often think of as a feudal system, where land is held through a chain of people ultimately up to the king, whereas previously the king had some authority, but basically the land belonged to the landowner. And not surprisingly, a lot of the people in Norway didn't like that change. You can see the pattern most clearly in Egil's saga, which is my very favorite saga, I think, which starts out with Egil's grandfather, who's somebody who is sort of a famous Viking, only getting a little bit old, but still pretty tough. And when the king of the little kingdom he's in says, you know, come along with me, I and some allies are going to attack Harald before he attacks us, his reply is, nope, I'm obliged to fight in defense of the kingdom and not outside the kingdom's boundaries. And besides, Harald is full of luck and you've got not a handful. And Harald wins and conquers the kingdom, and Harald wants this guy to come to court, basically, and he says, nah, no luck for our family and me and him. You have the impression that Kveldulf, who's Egil's grandfather, sort of knows more than he ought to know, kind of thing, is a sort of a vague hint of supernatural stuff. And there's also a hint at the beginning that he may be a werewolf in the Norse sense, which isn't the modern fantasy sense, that he may be somebody who at night, when he's asleep, his consciousness goes out in animal form. But in any case, you've got hints of that in the saga in various places. So Kveldulf refuses to go to court, which is going to cause a problem because he's a prominent person, and a friend of his who's one of Harald's retainers persuades Kveldulf's older son to come to court. And the son, who is sort of typical, handsome, brave, strong Viking hero, unlike his father and younger brother, who are ugly, strong, brave, slightly spooky Viking hero types, sort of, you see two quite different prototypes, as it were, in the saga. So anyway, the son goes to court and everything goes well for a while, but then the son is a little bit too successful and some of his rivals at court persuade Harald that he's a threat, and Harald attacks him and burns the hall he's in and kills him. And Kveldulf's son cuts his way through the people around Harald, dies just in front of Harald, and his death words are "one man short." It's a neat story, the whole thing. But in any case, at that point, Kveldulf and the younger son, Skallagrim, who's going to be Egil's father, decide that Norway is not a great place to be after all. And after sort of a bit of an interaction, which in effect, Skallagrim is in effect defying the, pretty much telling Harald, no, I don't want to work for you, I want to kill you, tough luck, I'm not going to be able to, they load up their people in their ships and head off to Iceland, which has been discovered fairly recently. And they're not the only people who did that. That's sort of the standard story, at least, of the settlement of Iceland, is it was settled by refugees, in effect, from Harald's unification of Norway. And Kveldulf and Skallagrim stop on the way, spend several days on some islands outside, off the Norwegian coast, and Kveldulf spends his day sitting on a rock on the island. And after a while, he sees a ship. And the ship is a ship that had belonged to his older son and had been seized by Harald after Harald killed the older son. And the ship is carrying two of Harald's nephews who are coming to court because their father has died and Harald's going to take care of them. And so Kveldulf loads up his ship with all of the fighting men in his party, attack the other ship. Harald's ship has more people on it, but Kveldulf and Skallagrim both go berserk, and one goes down one side of the ship and one goes down the other, and more men drown than die from blows. And when it's all over, Kveldulf fishes out one of Harald's people from the boat and says, go tell Harald that Kveldulf did it. Bye-bye. And then they go on to Iceland. And the point being that he's basically getting vengeance for the death of his son because Harald has refused to pay wergeld for the death of his son, which would be the normal procedure under Norse law as understood, but the king's view is basically that he's above the law, and so Kveldulf takes matters into his own hands, as it were, kills two of the king's kinsmen. So about 870 they start settling Iceland. In 930, it's settled enough, so the people who were there decide to send somebody back to Norway to collect information on laws so that they can work out a legal system. He comes, and they set up
what I regard as a very interesting legal system, which is based on traditional Norwegian law, but they've left out the king. They've decided that's one bit of the legal system they are happy to do without. And so you have this odd system, even by medieval standards, odd. Medieval societies are pretty different from modern societies, in which there is a legislature, there is a court system, but there is nobody at the center. There's no executive arm of government at all. And that's in 930. Around 1000, the Scandinavian world is going Christian, with various forced conversions, conflicts going back and forth, and so forth. And Norway is trying to pressure Norway. Iceland has kept close relations with Norway, even, I think, not even sure the king of Norway doesn't think he's the ruler of Iceland, although so he certainly doesn't exercise any actual power. But the king of Norway starts trying to pressure the Icelanders to go Christian. And some Icelanders have converted, a majority are still pagan. The king is doing things like seizing the ships of Icelanders when they come into Norwegian harbors and only letting them go when the guys say, yes, I'll become a Christian and be your man, so to speak. And some of the Christian converts come back to Iceland, and there are a few killings and some sort of general hostility, and the Althing meets the annual assembly in the year 1000, and the two sides declare themselves out of law with each other. It's as if they're imagining dividing the country into two, but with no geographical lines between them. And at that point, cooler heads prevail, and both the Christian and the pagan side agree to accept arbitration. And the arbitrator is the pagan law speaker, the person who presides at the annual assembly, basically, presides at the legislature, elected every 3 years from one of the four quarters of Iceland. And he, according to the story, puts a cloak over his head and lies there for 3 days thinking about the problem. And when he comes out of his seclusion, he announces that from now on, the religion of Iceland will be Christianity, but pagan worship is still legal as long as it is private and not public. And that conflict kills maybe as many as a dozen people out of a population of 50,000 or so, 70,000 maybe by then. And it's all over. And if you look at what happens elsewhere in the world over that particular fight, which is going through the world at the time, it's a pretty bloodless revolution, as it were. About 200 years after this, there's one problem in between, which I'm going to leave out, but about 1200, you start seeing increasing levels of violence. And I'll discuss a little bit later. It's a little unclear what the cause is, but you're moving from very small-scale conflict to battles with maybe 50 or 100 people or 200 people aside, and what look like coalitions trying to end up actually running things. And in 1263 to 1264, as a result of this, the Icelanders vote to make the King of Norway the ruler of Iceland. And that's sort of the end of the period I'm discussing. And I don't know very much. I'm not sure how much is known about what the institutions were like after that. Some is known, but to what extent they really changed. But still, that's a system that lasted for about a third of a millennium. If you compare it, say, to the American experience, our Civil War happened, about 80 years into the existence of our country. Was a whole lot more violent, I think, than their sort of extended Civil War, as it were. And, you know, we're still only, what is it now, a little over 200 years into it. So how does the legal system work? And the central figure is Goði. And the word actually comes from a word that means something like priest or God-man, because the original Goðar, which is the plural of Goði, seem to have been settlers who built temples for the pagan gods and sort of ran them. But by the time the legal system is set up, there really isn't a religious connection anymore. Goði is usually translated chieftain, and I think that's a mistranslation because that makes people imagine a clan system where you've got, and there aren't any clans, and you've got extended families, but that's, you know, like a father and three adult sons and their wives kind of thing, not what you think of in the Scottish kind of context as a clan. What the Goði is the link between the individual farmer and the Icelandic legal system. And it's a voluntary competitive system in the sense that if you're a farmer, you can pick any Goði in Iceland and say, may I be your thingman? Will you be my Goði? And if you don't get along, you can change. I'm not sure if you can change any. I think you can change any time, but maybe it's one month a year or something. But anyway, you're free to shift as long as there's some other goal that you will have you. And as you say, I think of it as sort of like state citizenship, in the sense that if two people have a legal conflict, what court at what level it goes to is going to depend on the relationship between their Gothar. That there's a sort of a tree structure in which you've got groups of three Gothar, which are called things. You've got groups of, I think, three things that are called quarters, and then you've got four quarters for all of Iceland. It's a little more complicated than that, because the North Quarter would never do things the way everybody else did, so they had 12 Gothar instead of 9, but each with three quarters of the rights of a regular one, so sort of complicated. But basically, it's a system so that if you and I are thingmen of Gothar who are in the same thing, we go to the local thing court for our dispute, and it then goes up according to how far apart not we physically are, but the Gothar are. And again, the Gothi's location is not defined by where he geographically is. It rather is like my American citizenship defined in France or something. It's each the right to be a Gothi. There are roughly 40 rights to be a Gothi out there. Each of them is associated with a particular location, and therefore, even if the guy who owns that right lived on the other side of Iceland, which is pretty unlikely, he would still be considered a part of that thing. So it's a voluntary, non-geographical, competitive system of allegiance. I've sometimes called it franchise feudalism, or competitive feudalism in that sense. And the word Gothord is used to mean two things. One of them is it's the set of rights that make you a Gothi. If you are a Gothi, you own a Gothord. And the other is it is the set of thingmen who have agreed to be the thingmen of that Gothi. And there were about 40 Gothord. They were transferable, marketable, and heritable. So if I was a Gothi, I could turn over my right to be a Gothi to you, and now you're the Gothi. I could sell it. I could leave it to my son. I could lend it to you for a while I went out of Iceland to be a Viking or something, and then get it back when I came back, and so forth. So as I say, sort of a little like a franchise, another way of thinking about it. And the court system, as I was saying, is determined by whose Gothor people are in. And it's a pure tort system. And what happens if the plaintiff loses and doesn't pay, sorry, the defendant loses and doesn't pay, is that the plaintiff goes back to the court to have the defendant declared an outlaw. And once the defendant is declared an outlaw, it is now legal to kill him, and it is tortious to defend him. So what in fact happens almost all of the time, with a few famous exceptions that lead to sagas, is that when you're outlawed, you leave. You've got, I think, 2-week window before the outlawry comes into effect. There's also a lesser outlawry, which is only for 3 years, but I'm leaving that out. So now I should say I'm also oversimplifying it, because a lot of the cases never go to court. A lot of cases are settled by arbitration. And some of them are just by agreement. That is, there's something you very occasionally give is that somebody gives his opponent self-judgment, meaning, I agree I'm in the wrong, you set my punishment, which is sort of a risky thing to do, but at the same time it's sort of a compliment to the other guy and maybe a way of ending the feud, especially if he's much stronger than you are and you want to end the feud a whole lot. So let's look at what you, if you imagine describing this as sort of a hypothetical system, it's very easy to show that any political or legal system you propose won't work. And what gives you a little humility in the project is if you see how easy it is to show that our system doesn't work either. That I remember when I published my first book, that my father's main criticism of it was that I had proved too much. That if the arguments I had offered were correct, we should all be starving to death, basically. We certainly weren't. And so let's run through the reasons this system can't work, think about them a little, and then look at how they dealt with them and why it did work. One obvious problem is the poor victim, which you can think of as analogous to the tort victim in our system who doesn't have the money to hire a lawyer. So in the Icelandic case, where everything is sort of decentralized self-action, unless I have friends or kinsmen who are willing to fight for me, what do I do if I try to go to court and the defendant and two of his tough friends just push me away and won't let me get there? in the more extreme case, if I win the case, how do I kill an outlaw if the outlaw's got half a dozen tough friends, maybe his sons or something, or his brothers, and I'm a 65-year-old guy who's, you know, got a limp and, you know, doesn't have any powerful friends and so forth. So that's one problem. That's the equivalent to I can't afford a lawyer. Second problem is, what about judgment-proof defendants? That if the defendant can't pay the fine, what's the point of prosecuting him? Why should I go to all the trouble? And if I win, what good does it do? And the third obvious system, I'm sure there are other problems, is the internal stability of the system. We don't have any government up there saying you've got to do it this way. There's no army, there's no police force. What happens if the loser, again, is a tough guy with friends, and he says, all right, you won the case, now go home again. Of course, that's happened in our system. There's a, you may know, a very famous anecdote about Andrew Jackson's response to losing a case with the Supreme Court, which was, if I remember correctly, what Justice Marshall has made the, is it Marshall, whoever it was, the Chief Justice has made the law, now let him enforce it. And he proceeded to drive a very large number of Indians off land he had no legal right to drive them off of, and a whole bunch of them died in the process. The so-called Trail of Tears came out of just that kind of scenario, if I remember the history correctly. But in the Icelandic case, you know, we would like to believe that can't happen in our case. It does happen in our society. I like to at least argue that the previous president confessed to multiple felonies a few years ago and nothing particular happened. Well, he has presidential immunity, but all the people at NSA who, at his orders, were violating the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act with penalties of 5 years and $10,000, none of them get prosecuted either. So it's a problem in any system, in a sense. Here are the supposed rules. What makes it stable? What keeps people from just ignoring those rules when they've got the muscle, political or military, or whatever to do? So, comments, thoughts, suggestions on how we deal with these problems? We know the system lasted for, as I say, a third of a millennium. Some of you have read it. I like their solution to the poor victim problem, and that is that a tort claim is marketable. So I'm this poor 65-year-old guy, and I go to my neighbor. And my neighbor, who I have a great deal of respect for, he's 40, and his four sons are 23 and similar ages, and they've just come back from a Viking expedition. And they got swords, and they got armor, and boy, are they tough guys, and they got friends, too, you know. So put together, they make a formidable force. And I say to him, look, that fellow over there killed my son. We had no excuse to do it. The punishment for killing a man is 200 ounces of silver. That's a lot of money. You can have 100 if you'll collect it. And so I can, in effect, transfer the tort claim to him on any mutually agreeable terms. I might just give it away to him on the grounds that I want to get revenge for my son, and I don't think he's going to pursue it unless he gets the whole amount. He might voluntarily do it. There are cases where the equivalent of the neighbor I've described, the tough guy, says, look, you don't have to give me anything. I don't much like the guy who you've got the case against, and I want to demonstrate to everybody that I'm, you know, an important person who can enforce the law and that people should look up to me, and he goes and forces the case through that way. So any terms mutually agreeable, I transfer the claim to him. He's got the resources to enforce the claim, and he goes and enforces it. So that's one solution. As I say, I think that would be arguably a useful feature in our legal system. What are the contexts in which you can transfer a tort claim in effect? How can you sell a tort claim, or who can you sell a tort claim to in our system?
Your insurance company
by subrogation. Who are tort claims most often sold to, routinely sold to? What?
Attorneys.
I would call that the less common, but you're right. A contingency fee, you're in effect selling part of your claim to the attorney. Who's the only other person you can sell it to? Happens all the time. You'll be doing it yourself if you're engaged in the litigation. The defendant, exactly, right? That's what an out-of-court settlement is. You're selling your claim to the defendant. But none of those really is adequate, because if you think about the case where you're somebody who is not an insider in the legal system, who doesn't have the money to hire an attorney, and even if you have the money to hire an attorney, how do you know which attorneys are to be trusted? On the other hand, if you make a marketable, you say, I don't have to know that. I just auction the thing off. Whatever law firm will pay me the highest price for my claim, that's the one I want to go to. Part of the deal, of course, is that I'll testify and, you know, help them out with whatever I can. But the basic idea is that what I want to know is how much is it worth to them. And once I know that, that's all the information I need about how good they are. Whereas a contingency fee, I got to worry a whole lot, both about the lawyers in some way cheating me in the sense of putting a lot, writing a lot off to expenses, but also about the fact that the lawyer who offers me the highest percentage may not be the one who's most likely to win the case. So I think it's at least arguable that that would be a nice system for us. I think I discussed that a little bit later in my outline, but raising it here. Second problem is the judgment proof defendant. And I think there are really two answers. One of them is the judgment proof defendants are less of a problem if the result of being judgment proof is that somebody kills you. And in fact, I think we know that, because my understanding is that loan sharks don't have as big a problem with judgment-proof defendants as people in legal markets do, because their enforcement mechanisms are likely to involve illegal uses of violence, and you therefore have a really strong incentive to pay off your debts. Loan sharks, gamblers, I think people in general in illegal markets. So being judgment-proof is, as it were, partly an external fact of nature and partly a result of choices you make. And that's true at two stages. First, if you know that if you do something and it's judged tortious and you lose the case, you're going to get killed, that's a good reason to be more careful what you do. And second, at the stage when you've lost the case, if, as in our system, the result of being judgment proof is that you don't pay, you have no incentive to try to raise money, and you have a considerable incentive to try to hide assets. So I gather the standard thing nowadays, if you're about to lose a whopping big tort judgment, is you buy a very expensive house in Florida, because in Florida, as I understand it, your personal residence can't be seized for satisfying a tort judgment. And you can think of a lot of different versions of that. So to some extent, simply having a backstop, as it were, having a legal system where if you can't pay your damages, something very bad happens to you, doesn't much matter. My purpose is what it is going to reduce the problem a good deal, because now if you're in that situation, first you're going to try to avoid the situation more carefully, flipping it. Under our system, if you know you're judgment proof, why worry, you know, about doing things that might result in losing a tort case? And second, it means that when you do lose the case, you're going to go to everybody you have any hope of getting any money from and say, can you lend me money? I'll do this for you. I'll sell you this, so forth and so on. So you're going to be less, doesn't solve the whole problem, but it's going to reduce the problem. Second thing they have, what was essentially temporary slavery, so that under some circumstances, the defendant who couldn't pay his damages became a debt thrall. Thrall was the Icelandic term for slaves. They had slaves up to, I think, the 11th century. They, in fact, abolished it pretty early. Slaves were largely war captives. Shouldn't really say war. We're talking about Viking raids. You raid someplace, and if you're lucky, you carry off some slaves. And so debt thrall would be another, your fellow Icelander who's lost the case and has agreed to work for you for... It's a funny way of putting it, because he could leave Iceland alternatively, but if he wants to stay in Iceland, he doesn't want to be outlawed, he ends up being a death thrall. So that's a sort of interesting approach. It has problems. I think I may have discussed a little bit at an earlier stage in the course that you worry about making it too easy for people to use the legal system to expropriate other people, which by making it easy to make people your slaves, obviously there's a risk of doing it, but at the same time it does provide a solution. And the stability is the one that is much more useful for us, but it's interesting in terms of trying to make sense of the system. Because I think what's going on is that if I refuse to either pay my damages or if I let them outlaw me, in effect, and having been outlawed, I then you come to fight me, I kill you because I got more friends than you do. That part of the problem is that because the defenders of the outlaw are violating the law and the attackers aren't, if anybody on the attacker's side is hurt or killed, he or his kin now have a claim. Whereas if anybody on the defender's side is killed, they don't have a claim. Consequently, if you try to tough it out, the coalition against you is going to keep expanding. Because each time there's a violent conflict, a couple more people now sue you, in effect, and either you pay them or they and their friends joined the coalition against you. And there's one case that I mentioned briefly in the 11th century. There's what looks like it might be a system of societal breakdown that then doesn't. And that's one where you, most of the feuds, almost everybody's a neutral. That is the typical feud. You're talking about, you know, 10 people aside, maybe, if that, not counting children and such, which means that most of the population is neutral, and trying to do things that are seen as lawless is going to tend to offend all of those neutrals and pull them in against you. And this was one where, for some reason, you ended up with coalitions on the two sides, which between them represented quite a sizable chunk of the population. So one side uses violence to prevent the other side from going through the legal procedures necessary to sue them, essentially. And the two sides arrive at the all thing sort of loaded for bear, and cooler heads prevail, and they agree to accept arbitration, and somebody, some neutral party, gives an arbitrated settlement that everybody can live with, and they go home, and that's the end of that particular problem. But the story that I like, actually, because it's a clearer illustration of this, is from Njalssaga. Njalssaga is probably the most famous, certainly one of the couple most famous of the sagas, though I like Egilssaga better. And there's a point at Njalssaga where there's a law case going on in the Althing, at the annual assembly, sort of in the national courts, as it were. And things are breaking down, and it looks as though it's going to end up with violence. It looks as though the two sides are going to sort of pull out swords and start killing each other, trying to. And somebody on one side goes to a guy who's sort of benevolent neutral. You know, he's sort of friendly to them, but he's not involved in it. He says, look, if it does turn into violence, what could you do to help us? And he says, I'll tell you what. I'll get my people drawn up over there armed, and if you're losing, we'll break up the fight. If you're losing, you can retreat behind us, and that'll break up the fight. And if you're winning, we'll break up the fight before you've killed more people than you can afford. So the implicit assumption is that even though things are breaking down badly enough so that it looks as though the trial is going to turn into a brawl, once the dust is cleared, if you've killed somebody, you're going to have to pay for it. It's very expensive to pay for killing somebody, and therefore you have to be very restrained on who you kill. And that was sort of a neat description, implicitly, of the internal stability of that system. All right. Other problems. What about gaming the legal system, which is, you know, sort of something that I guess lawyer stories in America are full of, and I think almost all societies are, when somebody says, well, yes, indeed he did it, but the following detail of the law says you can't prosecute him. And there's one case, actually, in Njalssaga, again, which is quite cute, where what happens is that the defendant is himself a gothi. And since he's a gothi, the plaintiffs know which court to sue him in, because they know where his own gothort is. So before the case gets to court, he quietly transfers his gothort to an ally and makes himself the thingman of another gothi who's an ally, who's in a different quarter of Iceland. So that, sort of as if the governor, as if Schwarzenegger, in order not to be sued in California, temporarily resigned and became a citizen of Nevada or something. And so now the plaintiffs sue him in the court appropriate for where they think he is. And he promptly countersues them for violating the law by suing him in the wrong court. What do you think is the simple Icelandic solution to situations where it's perfectly clear that somebody is doing the equivalent of that? Think outside the box. You killed my brother, and by some legal trickery, you're going to get away not outlawed. Well, what do we do? What would any red blooded Viking do?
Get his own army.
Well, we both have armies. I mean, small armies. We're talking about small numbers, but I got my buddies here. You got your buddies here, and it doesn't have to be here after all. You know, we're going to be living in Iceland in the same island for a long time. What's the obvious thing to do if you've killed my brother and I can't get, because of your trickery, I can't get the law to do anything, or at least I'm frustrated at how hard you're making it for me to do. Law to do anything. Nonsense. Sure, I kill the guy who killed my brother, and now we have another law case. Well, we got a claim against your side for weregeld for my brother, you got a claim against our side for weregeld for the guy I just killed. Cancel. And there is, in fact, it's not the same situation, actually, but there's, again, a famous little bit in Njalssaga, sometimes referred to, I think, as the killing duel, in which you've got two women, the wives of two men who are good friends, and the women hate each other. And so one of them gets one of the people in her, one of the men in her household, to kill some minor person in the other woman's household, I think a thrall or something. The other woman gets somebody on her household to kill the guy who did it. And I think by it's over maybe six people, something like that, and killed. You've got this back and forth. Meanwhile, the two husbands are passing the same purse of silver back and forth as they pay the wehrgeld for the killings their wives have arranged. Right. So again, it's probably an oversimplification. I haven't actually lived in that society, but it looks as though that was one of the reasons why it wasn't prudent to push too far in gaming the system. Final problem, which is related partly to the judgment-proof defendant thing, which is the cost of finding out who the criminal is, if that's too high, and if he might not pay. If you do find him, it may not be worth the trouble. And in the Icelandic system, concealing a crime was itself not only sort of an aggravating, or whatever you call it, circumstance, it was also shameful. And my favorite story for that, again, out of Egilsaga this time, is that when Egil is a relatively young man going a Viking with his friends, they attack some village on the Baltic coast. I'm not sure who the people are, maybe Slavs or something. And unfortunately, the people they attack are ready for them. And the Vikings get made prisoner instead of the other way around. The other people throw nets over them by a hedge.